Hi, Bob.
How are you?
Fine, Bob. Thank you for asking me to have this interview with you.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm glad you could make the time. I should say that I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Akbar Ahmed, very distinguished scholar of Islam, and you've also served in Pakistan's diplomatic corps. And perhaps most relevantly, you've got a book coming out that you've done, I guess with some other people, called Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam. And this involved a number of you going around to mosques throughout America, right, and kind of documenting the varieties of Islam that are practiced in America.
Yes, Bob, this is a project that I undertook for my sabbatical year, and I took a team of young researchers who work with me. Some of them had traveled with me to the Muslim world previously. We went to the Middle East, to South Asia, to Far East Asia, and I wrote up a book called Journey into Islam. This book took me and my team throughout the United States. We went to 75 cities. We visited 100 mosques, and we spent about a year in the field visiting communities and mosques, from the biggest mosque in New York and on one coast to America, and then right across the continent and into the Pacific, the farthermost, westernmost mosque in Honolulu, and of course the northernmost and the southernmost, and a whole variety of mosques,
mm-hmm.
And of course communities. And we also talked, of course, to non-Muslims. So we asked non-Muslim neighbors of Muslims, Jews, Christians, whoever, what they thought of Muslims, and we had a set of questionnaires which we gave to our respondents, and they filled them in. And so we have really what I think is a quite unprecedented look, a glimpse into Muslim society in America today.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think one thing a number of Americans would ask you if you told them about this project, if they didn't ask you, they might be thinking it, and that is, should we be worried about what's going on inside mosques in America? And one thing I took away from reading the excerpt from your book in Foreign Policy is that, first of all, there's no simple answer to the question of what's going inside mosques. There's a tremendous variety of things. But what would you, if somebody asked you the question that bluntly, should we be worried, what would you say?
Bob, I would say read my book.
Okay.
And I mean this on a serious level, because, you know, there's so much.
Right.
There is so much being written about mosques, about the imposition of Sharia, about the role of the imams. And unfortunately, we don't seem to know very much about precisely these questions. So a lot of the stuff you're seeing in the media and the so-called experts and so on are writing on the basis of ideology, sometimes on the basis of just common sense, sometimes plain ignorance. Sometimes, I hate to say this, but sometimes a tinge of prejudice comes into their writing. So there's a lot of misinformation and lack of information on mm-hmm. precisely these issues. So ours really is a very authentic look at society today. I'm an anthropologist, Bob, and mm-hmm. I notice you're from Princeton, and I was there this weekend. I spent the weekend lecturing at my old department, the Department of Anthropology. And mm-hmm. again, we anthropologists look at society and hold what is called a mirror up to mm-hmm. society. So we look at society in all its hues and variety, and the good, the bad, the ugly, everything. And with that, we are able to present a snapshot of society at that moment in time. So mm-hmm. the question about the mosque, for example, now we have been to 100 mosques. We've divided the mosques into mosques that are influenced by the mystics, the Sufis, for example, the universal humanists, mm-hmm. second and, category.
And could I interject by way of background that the imam who has gotten the most publicity in America recently, the one in New York who planned to build the Islamic Community Center, which would include a mosque, you know, near Ground Zero, is himself a Sufi from that tradition, and he is one of the people you talk about in this book.
Exactly, and the paradox or the irony is, of course, that Imam Rauf is a Sufi, as
right.
we've been to his mosque. And again,
right.
his mosque had, it was a very typical Sufi mosque. We saw a female imam that day. The Imam Rauf was not present himself. He was touring. And the female imam, a wonderful, eclectic attitude to religion. She adored Rumi and adored the founding fathers and Jefferson, and she brought a very eclectic kind of approach to Islam, a white convert herself. And that evening, we noticed, we talked to people who would come in and go out as the rituals began. We chanted the name of God, we held hands and went in a circle. Now, these things don't happen in mainstream mosques, Orthodox mosques or literalist right. mosques, which is one category of mosques that we've identified. And of course, about 30 to 40% of people present in that mosque were non-Muslims. A lot of Jewish, young Jewish people were present that night. So again, the paradox that Imam Rauf has now become the symbol of, according to some commentators, hardline, and some suspect him for his terrorist links and so on and so on. So that is the nature of the debate in America today. But back to the mosques in America. So mystics, the first category. The second category you could call the literalists, those who believe that a Muslim must live exactly as ordered to or as the text, the sacred text, demands us to live, so that if I don't have a beard, which I don't, I will not be a good Muslim according to their definition. Or if I'm wearing a tie, then I'm even a worse Muslim. And so on, a woman must wear a hijab. Now, a lot of literates would be that strong about their identity as Muslims. A lot of them would feel Islam is under attack, Islam must be defended. A lot of them would argue in a very strong, robust way to defend Islam. And those mosques tend to be very defensive in terms of guests who come there, in terms of how they project Islam, and in terms of what they see as quote-unquote the purity of faith. Mm-hmm. The third category is that of the modernist mosque. The modernist mosque is the mosque which wants to be more open, more in tune with what America is, or the culture of America. A lot of them would be middle-class, sophisticated people who are proud of being Muslim, but also proud of being American, and would say, look, there's no incompatibility between the two. This is a mosque like any other house of worship. It's as good or as bad as any other house of worship. And as Muslims, we want to promote dialogue, and we may go in and talk to the Jews in the synagogue or the Christians in church to promote understanding and interfaith dialogue. So you can see the three distinct types of mosques, and then immediately the tension between these. And it gets more complicated, Bob, because, I mean, Americans, I don't blame them for being a bit confused about mosques. It is a confused picture, because the leadership of the mosque, the leadership that runs the mosque itself, which is the board of the mosque, is very often the battleground for debates, tension, conflict between groups from, say, the Middle East, or from South Asia. And this, of course, is the classic confrontation. The Arabs have the language, the language of the Quran, which is Arabic. The Prophet of Islam is Arab, and so on.
Some of these mosques are very multi-ethnic in that regard, is the impression I got from reading the excerpt from your
book. They are. They're very multi-ethnic. So, for example, when we went to New York, the biggest mosque in New York, and we prayed there and met the imam and met people there, and I was amazed at the variety of people. There was a Turk, and there were people from Malaysia and Bangladesh and Syria. The imam himself is from Indonesia. So you can see the range. Because, you know, Bob, America is incredible in terms of the Muslim presence. Every kind of Muslim is present here. We met Cambodian Muslims, Bangladeshis, Afghans, every kind of Muslim. So keep that in mind. Now, of course, there's another problem, and this is the problem I identify in my book, which is the role and training of the imam. Now, this is a central figure in a mosque. The imam is the man who runs the prayers, runs the mosque, and so on. Now, who is the imam? He delivers the sermon on Fridays, which is the big prayer for Muslims. It's the sacred day, like Sundays for Christians. Now, who is the imam? Where is he trained? Is he trained in Egypt, in the traditional Islamic institutions, or Pakistan, or in some other conservative institution? How is he going to then guide and mentor a lot of the young Muslims who are growing up in America, who are born here, who may have problems like any other teenager, who are wrestling with problems of drugs or drinking or alcohol and doing things that they should not be doing? Now, who do they talk to? In Muslim culture, there's a kind of formality between the older and the younger generation. Kids aren't as free as they are with non-Muslim families. So therefore, they may automatically go to a spiritual mentor or guide. Now, if the imam comes from abroad and is not familiar with American culture, he's going to find it very difficult, A, to relate to that culture, the local culture, and B, to advise these youngsters. And therefore, a lot of the youngsters you're seeing will then go online and maybe end up by being guided and advised by imams abroad. And so there you have a new dimension in the Muslim community, which is the international dimension.
So you're saying, regardless of whether the imam is modernist or literalist, in your division, if he comes from abroad, he just may have trouble relating? Or is it
yes.
the case that most of the ones who come from abroad are going to be in the literalist tradition?
No, this is a great question. I would say that, again, the imams, even those coming from abroad, tend to belong to one of the three categories. So there may be a mistake. They may mm-hmm. a mistake mosque, for example, let's say there's a mosque, the one we went to in New York, wants an imam, the old imam is retiring, or they want an assistant imam. They will look for someone who is like them. So they are going to get someone in the mystic tradition, but on the basis of reputation or training back home in Egypt or Pakistan or wherever. The problem is something else. I'm now talking in terms of culture.
Right.
The problem is that imam coming, and I know many of them personally, well-meaning mm-hmm. people, they're coming from an entirely different culture, an entirely mm-hmm. different cultural context. And a lot of these youngsters, and I have pointed this out, I haven't pulled my punches, Bob, I've been very harsh, and in fact, that's why a lot of Muslims are not very comfortable with some of the things I've said, because they felt I needed to be much more tactful or diplomatic or even maintaining a veil over some of these issues. But I have pointed out that these homegrown terrorists, which are now so much in the spotlight, they are really locals. They are Americans. They are American kids. The five young men from Virginia, Faisal
right.
Shahzad, they wanted to blow up parts of New York.
Sure.
New Jersey, we had a recent emergence of more homegrown terrorists. Now, these are kids who are growing up here. And to me, as an anthropologist, my question is, who is instructing them? Who's guiding them? Who is failing to guide them so that mm-hmm. they begin to want to harm or injure their own people, which is Americans. You're
right.
growing up in America, you owe everything to America, you're educated here, your family's living here, your future's here, and yet you want to harm this country. So why is this happening, number one? Number two, if they want, like all youngsters, they have a lot of energy, they want to blow off steam, they want to do something, change the world, all right, go abroad, go to Pakistan, go to Afghanistan, join a school, join a medical school, help with the misery there. The people there are desperate for medical advice, medical guidance, medical help. They're desperate for education, for teachers in schools. Work there and form a kind of peace corps so that those people begin to say, wonderful, you're coming here as great ambassadors from America. Mm-hmm. You're ambassadors of Islam. You're also ambassadors of America. And they will act as a great bridge between America and the mm-hmm. Muslim world.
Okay, so as far as what kind of guidance they're going to be getting at their local mosque, I guess if you had to generalize, I gather you would say that the average American would rather that they were in a mosque in the either modernist or mystic tradition, which isn't to say that all the mosques in the literalist tradition are bad by any means, and I'm sure there are various different kinds of mosques in the literalist tradition. Is that right? But if I could...
Bob, first of all, let's clarify this. And this is an important nuance that you brought up.
Uh-huh.
The mosques in the literalist tradition, we should be very cautious. We must not jump to any conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the literalist means... Like the literalist, incidentally, Bob, we need to inject a broader discussion here on this topic. Read Karen Armstrong, The Battle
right.
for God. And she, on the basis of very scholarly, very thorough study, establishes that each faith, each of the Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have exactly the same tension between what she calls the moderates and the fundamentalists. And she
right.
goes over history for the last 2,000 years and explains what's going on in each one of these faiths. So in a sense, what I'm describing is quite common and quite apparent even in the other faiths. Now, so the literalists are basically people who are saying, look, we want to be left alone with our faith. We want to be able to practice our faith and worship in the way we want to. It does not mean that they're saying we want to blow up people or inflict violence on other
no,
people.
No, but it does tend to be the case that the small minority of young Muslims who do go in that direction, unfortunately, are much more likely to be associated with the literalist tradition.
Now,
right?
Bob, this is what we would think. But mm-hmm. pause for a moment and take the case of, for example, Faisal Shahzad. Now,
mm-hmm.
he seems to me very much, if you were to put him in a category, he grows up in Pakistan in the frontier province,
mm-hmm.
which is very much a tribal society. And he grows up with the reputation of being somewhat of a party guy and a party boy. Now,
mm-hmm.
that in Pakistan, in the tribal areas or near the tribal areas, he grows up near Peshawar, would seem very, very incompatible with his surroundings. He mm-hmm. then comes to America, and all the pictures of him are, you know, of a modern young man. He doesn't have a beard. He's dressed up in Western or smart clothes. He's wearing the latest dark glasses, and he's got these gadgets with him, etc., etc.
But then so, he changes, right?
He changes, but he changes again for interesting reasons. Again, the media would have us believe it was the violence in the Quran and so on in the religion mm-hmm. of Islam. But hear what he's saying. He is, in fact, saying, I am taking revenge for the drone strikes in the tribal
right.
areas. So he's acting more like a tribesman who is involved in Pashtun Wali, the mm-hmm. code of the Pathans, which one of the primary features of that is revenge, rather than anyone saying, you know, I'm going to have a jihad, or I've been trained by the literalists mm-hmm. and so on. So he's not coming out of that literalist tradition.
Did he wind up affiliated with a literalist mosque in America?
Again, whatever yeah. little we know, because, you know, there's a lot of conjecture in the media.
Uh-huh.
What little we know, he could be in the modernist camp, in the way he mm-hmm. lived, in his background, in his education, in his thinking, and even in the sense that he wants to do something violent.
Mm-hmm.
So the thesis is a sophisticated one, which means that any of the three categories, by definition, could produce young people who are confused or who are mm-hmm. Angry and who could be provoked into violence. Even the mystic Sufi who would not think of violence, he would be, in fact, denying his Sufiness if he went into violence. He could be, I mean, suppose someone burns the mosque or someone does something violent against their community, he could be provoked as just being human to react with anger. That's a human emotion. At the same time, the modernist, we must not simply say it is the literalist alone producing mm-hmm. Young men who would want to do something violent, because the five young men from Virginia, I mean, they were regular American kids going to high school here, playing basketball, baseball, and so on. And yet they were prepared to go off to Pakistan and join the jihad in Afghanistan.
Yeah. I mean, maybe an interesting question is, to the extent that these young people go off in the wrong direction and get inspiration that they think of as authentically Islamic inspiration to do this, are they more likely to get it in an American mosque, or are they more likely to get it like on the internet? I mean, as you said, one of the great dangers is that they fail to find any kind of guidance they can relate to in their local mosque and wind up looking for it outside of a mosque altogether, right? Which do you think is the...
Well, this is the big question, Bob, and this is what concerns me. I would want a structure in place where these youngsters growing up in America, and now, by the way, going through a very difficult phase for the Muslim community. You know, Bob, step back a little bit and think of society in America today. You know, we have this economic crisis in the background. We have debt to the tune of trillions and trillions of dollars. We've got a war that seems interminable, unending war, the longest war in American history going on in Afghanistan. We have the issue of the immigration issues, the Mexicans and the Hispanics and so on. And we have the first non-white president in the White House. And then the big looming issue of Islam, the nature of Islam, the potential quote-unquote threat of Islam and so on. So all these issues are making Americans very uncertain, mm-hmm. anxious, even mm-hmm. nervous. Now, in this context, think of what the Muslim community is going through. The Ground Zero Mosque controversy, the pastor in Florida wanting to burn the Quran, the Murfreesboro Mosque being denied permission just to be built, other mosques that we saw on our journey either attacked or firebombed in the case of Columbia and Tennessee and so on. So the Muslim community really is going through a very difficult period of its history here in the United States. Now, when you look at the youngster then in the community, you realize the pressure on this young 18-year-old, 19-year-old Muslim boy, usually boy, not so much the girls, because they have other ways of absorbing this pressure. Now, he can either break and go off and do something stupid and violent, or then absorb himself in the system and say, look, I am American. All communities have been through this rough patch, and I'm going to, in the end, prevail, and I'm going to prevail by becoming an creating bridges with the American community, the larger American community, and really appreciating and enjoying my being American, being here in the United States. So this is the dilemma. Now, who is advising them? Who is guiding them? What role are the imams playing? What role are the parents playing, the older generation? And the big question I ask is Muslim political leadership failing these youngsters? Because I would say, yes, on the basis of evidence, if you have not one, not two, but a stream of so-called homegrown terrorists emerging, something is failing somewhere in the community.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing, you mentioned Karen Armstrong's book, where she talks about fundamentalism in various faiths. And I think part of her thesis is that one thing that creates fundamentalism or encourages it is a sense of threat. Sometimes it's physical threat, people want your land, but sometimes it's a sense of cultural threat, a threat to your values. Do you see in America a sense among Muslims, is that a factor in driving some American Muslims toward extremism? Is there in one sense or another a sense of threat, whether or not it's a valid sense?
It is. There is a great sense of threat after 9/11. I think a lot of people, Muslims and non-Muslims, assume that after 9/11, the gap that had opened between American Muslims and non-Muslims, that gap would slowly begin to close and that, you know, business as normal would proceed. But in fact, we've seen after almost 10 years, and we confirmed this in the field, and you can read the material, the very rich case studies and Journey into America, that gap remains as wide as ever, if not wider. Many, many Americans we talked to on our journey actually had this question of us. They said, can Muslims really be proper Americans, good Americans? Mm-hmm. Now, this is a concern, and Muslims, again, need to answer this question. Because otherwise, everything around Muslims, any controversy, whether it's the Ground Zero Mosque or the pastor in Florida, is immediately fed into this bigger question, which is, can Muslims be good Americans? Can they be trusted? Can we live next door feeling comfortable with Muslims? A lot of Americans are saying no. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we have a challenge because we are ultimately talking about American citizens. These Muslims living in the United States are American citizens. So when citizens or individuals are so much under pressure, you can expect some of them to crack or go over the brink. And mm-hmm. I suspect that is part of the explanation in the case of many of these homegrown terrorists that we are seeing over the last few months.
Mm-hmm. Are there things that you could do from a point of view of American policy to make American Muslims feel less under threat in that particular way? I mean, I know that you think that part of the problem is that they aren't, the young American Muslims are sometimes not getting better guidance from older Muslims, and that's one issue. But in terms of the role played by American policy, just suppose that you were magically put in charge of all aspects of American policy, ranging from, you know, airport security to our foreign policy to the speeches that the president gives or other politicians give. Suppose you could pull any of these levers. Are there things you would do that you think would improve the situation?
Bob, I have a whole chapter on this. My last chapter is precisely going through a checklist of what Americans and Muslim leadership need to be doing. For example, look at the previous cycle, the African Americans up to the 50s and 60s facing all kinds of discrimination, and yet in the end being absorbed and largely not completely successfully, but in large measure into the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Previously, before that, go back another half century, you have the Jews. Another half century, or maybe not so far back, you have the Italians, the Catholics. So this is a process that we are familiar with in history. So first of all, we have to understand the problem. They understand the problem of the immigrant community coming here, having a rough ride at first, but then eventually being absorbed and becoming like any other part or any other individual living in America. Now, what helps immensely, and we need to accelerate the process for Muslims because we don't have so much time. We are living in a world which is interconnected. So what's happening in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, the Middle East is affecting us here in America and vice versa. So we don't have that much time. We don't have the luxury of sitting in America alone and saying we'll resolve our problems because the world is watching us. We are living under a magnifying glass, a microscope. So what we can be doing very successfully, and it's sort of beginning to happen, we need to make sure that Muslims are more visible. They were almost invisible. How many Muslims do you see on the main television channels or writing op-eds or out there as major figures, so that very, very few Americans even know of Muslims who are prominent. So that very often, and this has major implications, if there's a debate on Islam on one of your major channels, and I see this all the time, you have four people debating Islam and commenting on Islam and its theology and its culture and its sociology, invariably they're going to be non-Muslim. They're not even scholars of Islam. So therefore, what you're going to get is a lot of people commenting on Islam, and very often, airing their prejudices or their opinions or just their comments, which means that a lot of Americans are getting their ideas of Islam and these Muslims in America from people who know very little about the community. So therefore, one great help both to Americans and to Muslims would be to start involving Muslims much, much more vigorously. That will help both Americans and the Muslims and internationally to show that, look, here are these Muslims and they're doing just as well as any other community, and America does not hate Muslims or is not on the warpath against Islam. Very important when you consider General David Petraeus out in Afghanistan constantly saying we need to win hearts and minds. So that's one thing we could be doing. We need to be learning a lot about each other. I would urge Muslim leaders, I've said this in my book, they need to understand American culture much more seriously. They need to reach out, they need to visit synagogues, churches, understand the history of this country, the civil rights movements, Martin Luther King Jr., what did he stand for? Go back to the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, what were they fighting for? What were the principles that involved this great battle that took place in the 19th century? Go back to the Founding Fathers. Read what Jefferson was saying in Franklin and the doings of Washington. So this is for the Muslims, because too few Muslims, particularly of the older generation, really understand American culture. Similarly, for Americans, they need to understand Islam in a much more nuanced way than they're doing now, which is getting the information from blogs and these television discussions. To understand that these 5, 7, 8 million Muslims living in America are Muslims, but they're also, in a sense, representing a much larger civilization, an older civilization, and a very old and at times a very splendid civilization, which gave great contribution to in terms of architecture, literature, art. At times, in fact, it carried the torch of civilization. In Muslim Spain, it was the Muslim rulers there who, with their Jewish and Christian scholars, were able to translate all the Greeks, Plato, Aristotle, mm-hmm. Socrates, and thereby trigger what we know as the Renaissance in Europe, and thereby bring Greek learning back into Latin and into the local European languages, which in turn, of course, influenced people like Thomas Jefferson. So again and again, we need to look at each other not so much as us and them, but in terms of yet another community, the Muslim community, which is coming to the table, to the American table, this rich feast of great cultures coming from all over the world and bringing something to the table. And then above all, we need to focus on the young. These are young Americans. They may be Muslim. They may be any other religion. And we need to make them feel as part of this landscape, as part of this country. And today, with the immense pressure on ordinary people and particularly on Muslims, I find I was at Princeton this weekend and I talked specifically to some of the young Muslim students there. And Muslims are feeling a great deal of heat right now. You know, the fact that
more recently, as a result of the recent controversies.
Yes, Bob. Recently, particularly the last few months. I mean, just think of it. If you're a Muslim, Bob, if you're you were at Princeton. Suppose you were back to 18 years old, and on television, the prophet of your religion is abused. Your God is abused. You're called in part of an evil religion. Constantly, you're being challenged simply because your name happens to be a Muslim name. When you arrive at the airport or you're taking off at some other airport, you're being asked to step aside. And I talked to these kids in detail, and they said, as a matter of routine, we are asked to step aside. We spend 3-4 hours almost in routine. You know, there was a kind of resignation about them. And you begin to ask yourself, my God, how long are they going to sustain this kind of pressure? Because some of them are very close to snapping. And if they snap, what would they do? Would they want to talk to the elders? Would they talk to their parents or go to the imam? Who's going to talk to them? Who will advise them?
And, you know, it seems to me that as far as this pressure, you know, some of it comes from Americans who are just kind of overreacting. You know, they're sincere, they may be of goodwill, but they are overreacting to a threat that certainly exists, but they're exaggerating it in their minds, but they're doing so kind of innocently. On the other hand, excuse me, there are also some people who are systematically trying to whip up hysteria. And the most recent manifestation of this is this idea that Sharia might be imposed in America, which I think is just a completely crazy idea, right? And yet...
Well, Bob, I don't know whether you saw my little exchange with Frank Gaffney, who's the author of this.
Well, Frank Gaffney is the ringleader of this. I didn't see it, but I mean, Frank Gaffney... you know, he gets money from somebody at his little think tank in Washington to go around saying something completely crazy to scare people.
But you see,
right?
Bob, it was very interesting because I was on Anderson Cooper with him, and he, of course, had this booklet of his on Sharia, and he began by making this statement that Sharia is taking over and Muslims are about to take over, etc., etc. And Anderson Cooper asked me, he said, what do you make of that? And I said, look, your mathematics is probably better than mine. Explain to me how 2% of a population, even if every one of that 2% wanted the Sharia, could impose it on 98% who did not want it, and in a democracy, not in a military dictatorship. And to make it worse, for his argument, I said, back from where I come in Pakistan, 98% of the population is Muslim, and they don't have the Sharia there. So if they're not imposing it on their own society when they're 98% in the majority, how is it mathematically possible to impose it when they're 2%? It's mathematically absurd. And yet, the idea has taken hold. I go to a lot of lectures. I'm asked to speak at various forums. And invariably, this question comes up. We will not allow the Muslims to take over. We're going to fight for the constitution. We will defend it to our life, to the last, and fight to the death. I said, I'll be there fighting to the death with you for the constitution. And I said, there is no danger of us dying because there's going to be no Sharia imposed on us.
But do you know where it's coming from? I mean, why?
It's coming, Bob, from the environment. When you have an environment, you know, you yourself talked about it. When you have an environment, there's a crisis in the background, an economic crisis, a sense of political tension and drama taking place, a sense of a world crisis, the role of America in the future. And above all, Bob, you're talking about Islam. You know, my thesis is that while this debate is about Islam on one level, and 2% of our population is not a huge population, and really it's very, very marginal in America, it really is, the intensity is explained, the intensity of this debate around Islam is explained because this really is a debate about America. What it means to be an American. What will it mean to be an American in the future? This is the debate taking place. Is it the America as defined by you, Bob Wright, or is it the America defined by, say, Glenn Beck or someone else or someone else? This is the great debate taking place in America, and we need to be clear about the debate because when this debate ends, and America has a tradition of having these great debates, you know, every half a century or so, we saw in the 60s and 70s, you had this very intense debate about the civil rights movements and civil rights in America. Previously, you had the Civil War itself. So these debates become very intense because it is a great nation, and there's no doubt about the greatness of America as a nation, and a great continent, the American continent, really now looking at itself and intensely debating the future.
Okay. Well, I guess we can leave it there, unless there's something else you want to say about how we can shape that this debate in a useful direction. You've already said a certain number of things. Is there anything you want to say?
Yeah, well, Bob, what I do want to point out in terms of the debate about America, and this, again, something we learned on this journey of ours, and it's very prominent in my book, Journey into America, which is that for Americans, Muslim or non-Muslim, the inspiration for America, being American, American identity, really comes in the most definitive way from the founding fathers. They shape not only the Declaration and the Constitution, but they shape the idea of America, their ideas of a new kind of society, a society where people will have tolerance for each other, they'll have genuine respect for religious pluralism, democracy, human rights, civil liberties. These matter. And if we were to read Washington or Jefferson or Franklin, as we had to follow to write the book, you'd see them commenting on all the issues that we think are peculiar to our age, whether it's torture, the treatment of prisoners and so on. They're all there in the Founding Fathers. And ultimately, I want the people who are going to be listening to you or looking at you or reading you to remember this image that we have in our minds when we think of the Founding Fathers. It is a statue of Jefferson outside the university he created in Virginia with an angel. And the angel is holding a tablet. The tablet has on the top of it the words religious freedom, 1786. Mm-hmm. And beneath that, it has the word God for Christians, Jehovah for the Jewish faith, Allah for Muslims. And I said to myself, my God, 18th century, when the world is full of despots and tyrants, and here these Americans are thinking of a new kind of society. They're including Muslims. And mm-hmm. in those days, you can imagine how few Muslims would be actually living in America. And it gets better. Below that, it says Atma and Brahma, the names of God in Hinduism. So they're not only thinking of the Abrahamic faiths, they're thinking of the non-Abrahamic faiths. So this is the image, this is the metaphor that we as Americans need to hold on to, because in a world which is going to be uncertain and anxious and changing and sometimes violent, we need to have an ideal to hold on to. And there is no better ideal than the founding fathers, these great extraordinary figures that really, in a sense, gave us the shape and definition and very identity of America.
And in fact, Jefferson had a copy of the Quran, and he was very alert to the fact that all scriptures have their less fortunate verses. I mean, verses that could inspire people to do bad things, as well as verses that could inspire people to do good things, because he took the Bible and kind of cut out those things that Jesus said that he didn't think encouraged good behavior.
Exactly. I knew these are intellectuals. Bob, what I really admire about these founding fathers, they are men of action, but they're also intellectuals. So they're looking at things with this broad humanist tradition, humanist lens. And you're right. I mean, this is exactly how Jefferson was looking at even Islam. Franklin spoke of Islam in glowing terms. So did John Adams. He spoke of the Prophet of Islam as one of the great truth seekers of history, along with Socrates and Confucius. Jefferson, of course, owned the Quran and hosted the first iftar at the White House. Now, all this is documented, and in our book we've documented it. And these are facts that I think a lot of Americans would appreciate.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for writing the book. Thanks for taking the time to talk about it with us, and good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Okay.
You.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.